Welcome to the UCSF Sports Medicine Podcast, 6 to 8 weeks, Perspectives in Medicine. During our program, we continue to cover a variety of hot topics in the sports medicine world and more.
Welcome to our UCSF Sports Medicine Podcast, 6 to 8 weeks, with myself, Dr. Nira Pandya, and Dr. Brian Feely. Today, we have the pleasure of having Chris Ballard on, a journalist from the Bay Area, formerly would write for SI, still writing C articles in SI as well, too, working for Simon & Schuster and a professor at UC Berkeley. So, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. I'm a big fan of your work, and particularly the work that's kind of revolved around sports medicine and injury recovery that we'll get into. But maybe just start out with, from our audience, how did you get into this career? Like, where was the decision kind of as you're going through schooling to go into journalism and to write about sports?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. This is great. So I was a high school athlete and then a low-level Division III athlete. When I was introduced to journalism in high school, wrote for the school paper, and then in college ended up writing for the school paper, first at UC Santa Barbara and then at Pomona College. And then it sort of had that realization at some point that my playing days were going to come to an end, at least playing days that were, you know, competitive, right? And I'd really enjoyed the ability to look at the sports both from a player's perspective and from a journalist perspective. And Pomona, we happened to, bizarre confluence of events, happened to be there with Mike Budenholzer on the same basketball team right after Greg Popovich, which for a Division III school, obviously, is not the norm. So we got a little window into that and then graduated from Pomona. This was the one thing that I just got jazzed up about. I mean, I'm sure that you see that a lot of kids. It didn't feel like a job to me. And so being able to learn something new, being able to talk to people who were experts in whatever field it was, whether it was playing a sport or in your case, covering the medicine side of a sport, I think it was the continually learning that I enjoyed of it.
You grew up in, I would say, the best place to follow sports in the Bay Area. How has being around essentially, I would say, perpetually good teams at any given era, but also some monumentally bad teams affected either your writing style, your optimism or pessimism over the last couple of decades?
49ers, I'm of an age where the 49ers peaked in the 80s. Well, I don't know if they peaked then, but they first peaked, right? They first peaked when I was growing up. And then we suffered through a lot of down Warriors years. And that experience, I think, as a fan shaped me. And then when I first started covering the sports in the Bay Area for Sports Illustrated, it was in 2000, and I moved back here in 2004. And it was covering the Warriors through those bleak years was really fascinating because you saw how an organization that was dysfunctional worked. And then eventually, you know, when Lakewood comes in and, you know, Myers comes in and Jerry West comes in, you got to see the flip of that, an organization that was run so well, that was so far ahead, light years, of course, right, of the other ones in the NBA. Through that experience, you know, one of the constants is Raymond Ritter, and he is the media guru for the Warriors. He's exceptionally good at his job. He had been at the Lakers before that, and he provided this window to those of us covering it from the journalist side through all of this, through the Sprewell, through Nelly and We Believe, and then on up until today. And I think what it allowed you to see is the vast contrast between leadership styles in sports, between players, GMs, coaches, watching that evolve over time.
I have a follow-up on this, given the fact that we just watched the 49ers lose. I feel like when, even in 2012, when they lost, it was like tough break. They played great. If only things had gone a little bit differently. And now it feels like a lot of the media is Brock Purdy has to go. What's wrong with Kyle Shanahan? How has being a journalist been affected by kind of that transition away from long form journalism and more a somebody must be at fault and I need a soundbite?
Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm someone who spends months on a feature. So I'm neither a fan of that type of journalism or someone who's done much of it, or even frankly be that good at it, to be honest. But I do feel like it's a whole generation is growing up where this is their exposure to media, especially in the sports world, is these hot takes, the transactions, you know, who will be traded where, you know, Warriors made a play for LeBron, like boom, and that dominates the news. And that's great. You have this instant, you know, fire hose of information. And as a fan, I get that. I think what we miss now is the ability to have these in-depth objective features. Players are providing more access than ever. You know, being able to listen to Draymond Green speak for hours at a time on a podcast or Iguodala, it's amazing. I wish I'd had that when I was younger. At the same time, what we're lacking perhaps is someone who does a lot of research and then sort of puts someone or a team or a player or like Shanahan in a larger context. And there's still a lot of like excellent journalism out there. You know, the Athletic's Bay Area coverage is top notch, especially, I mean, the Warriors team is really good. but you don't have the opportunity, the resources, or the access, frankly, to do the kind of deep dive features that we once did. I'll give you one small example is when the Warriors were really bad in the early 2000s, I actually went to Raymond Ritter and I was still in my early 30s. And I proposed going through training camp with the team as a way to explain to the readers what it was like for them. There's no chance you could do that today. At the time, they actually ran it up the flagpole, and the concern very wisely was that I would injure a player, and you know, you couldn't afford that. But even if I were just running through the drills, that access was still sort of available then. Jack McCallum, who wrote for SI for many years, sat with the Suns on their bench for the better part of his season. And so his book, 7 Seconds or Less, about that is a level of outside, you know, a relatively objective view that you just can't get anymore.
Piggybacking off that, I mean, I think how do you get people to kind of read what you're writing with this snippet, you know, this culture of like, unless it says something really hot in social media, you know, like you brought up the Athletic, like Marcus Thompson writes these beautiful pieces about Clay's emotions, but no one reads it unless someone snaps, you know, a chat and puts it on. Like, how do you approach that in terms of your writing and when you're teaching students, like how to get their pieces noticed?
If you have any suggestions, I'm all ears. Yeah, it's increasingly hard. Often it comes down to, I think, the outlet or the accrued respect that a reader has for someone. So when I open The New Yorker, because I'm an old person who still reads the magazine, you know, the actual physical magazine, I'll read anything. I'll read a piece on an art museum. I'll read a piece on orthodontics, because my presumption is that it's in The New Yorker. Ergo, it means they spent a lot of time on it. It's going to be well-written. I'm going to be interested. So I think that still applies to a handful of publications out there. And if you can write for one of those, fantastic. For decades, Sports Illustrated was one of those. Sadly, it's, you know, a lot has changed there recently. Lacking that, really, you have to build that personal brand. We talked before we went on air about Andrew Huberman, and he has built up that brand and that audience to the point where, yeah, people listen to 2.5 hours about some medical condition or a concept that they really know nothing about. Like that, that's remarkable to get 2.5 hours of someone's time. So if you can do that, you know, people will read Zach Lowe and they'll read whatever he writes because he's built up that respect. Hard to sell that to someone who's 22 and just starting out, because they'll say, well, how do I build that? And that's the challenge of journalism today.
Do you think long form journalism will come back and there'll be more of a need for these long in-depth features, or do you think it's dead?
I think it will continue to be critical in a lot of areas of public life. I think sports may not be one of them. The importance of having long-form journalism when you're covering politics or world events or everything else where you can get that access. If you're going to write a deeply reported story about prison reform in New Orleans, you're going to be able to do investigative reporting and you're going to be able to get a ton of access to normal people because you can still do that. I did a story on LeBron James and his family a couple of years ago, and it was like 6 months to get half an hour and an afternoon with the James family, deeply negotiated. That's where we're at now for an outside person to tell someone's story when they can just tell their own. But I do think the core principles of it will just live on in different ways. Podcasts, for example, you know, Serial has done a great job of this. Many podcasts are taking on a narrative approach, documentaries. So perhaps it's just the core skills remain and maybe just not in written form.
Kind of shifting gears to some of your more current work, two of your articles that sports medicine physicians really caught our attention were your articles on the aging athlete and the use of kind of cold plunge and ice baths. Take us through like why you decided these topics, like why they came to your interest, which we really appreciate your ability to take all the scientific data and research and then be able to package it for the reader. Kind of take us through that process.
Well, thanks. They definitely came out of self-interest, I'll be honest. As an aging athlete myself, I had spent a lot of time thinking about this. I had this invincible period of my life athletically until about 37. And then I was diagnosed with arthritis both in my right hip and my right shoulder. Just years of playing basketball and tennis and, you know, concrete and asphalt. So I ended up getting a hip replacement. And I had this sort of reckoning with my own athletic mortality. You know, I talk about it in the story, you know, the concept of that day when you're going to have to stop playing, whether it's competitively or not. And I would have conversations with Steve Kerr about this a fair amount while covering the Warriors, because Steve, he finished his playing career and he had this vision of decades of recreational sports ahead of him. And as he will tell you, you know, he just went too hard right away. And he started just doing marathon tennis matches And all this broke down his body further in a way after the years of basketball, where he sort of had to reckon around the same time I have in his late 40s there. And then he ended up having some pretty serious medical complications, obviously. But he had to come to terms with that, you know, and how do you psychologically? And then the second question I was interested in was, how do you prolong that mortality? So someone who's 45 might be able to play till 60 rather than 55. And as you both know far better than I do, the advances in this field are happening like monthly. It's pretty remarkable. The steps you can take as an aging athlete in the next 6 months may have long range effects for you. But if you wait too long, it may be too late. So that concept to me is fascinating. And of course, I own all the devices at my house. I'm wearing Normatec boots at night and I'm taking cold plunges and I'm taking Mobic before I play basketball. So I'm almost a parody of the type of athlete who does this.
It's a really good point. That's one of the biggest transitions in sports medicine since when Nirav and I trained and now. And it kind of used to be, hey, if you were 40, you didn't see a sports medicine doctor. You saw the general orthopedic surgeon. And if you were injured, you were put on the, you're going to get a joint replacement in the future, but it's time to quit. And now it's a complete frame shift. Now it's, what can you do to remain active? What can you do to maintain a level of exercise and competitiveness, which is overall great, but we still struggle to explain your body is still going to degenerate a little bit and you're going to feel some things that don't feel like athletic success. And in fact, they feel like pain, and that might be okay also. And it's just your body's way of reporting, hey, I feel a little bit different. I have a follow-up on your cold plunge. How much do you think the cold plunge helps you, or does it reset you and remind you to have a healthy lifestyle because you were crazy enough to jump in really cold water in the day?
Yeah, as you both know, you know, a decent amount of the evidence on cold exposure remains either anecdotal or it's lacking rigorous studies. Or one of the things I've run into a fair amount is that the people running the study are also cold water devotees, yeah, especially in cold water swimming, or they're interviewing. There was a study that came out last month about menopausal women, where they interviewed 1,000 women who were into cold water swimming. And it was all self-reported, all these benefits they felt from it, but they'd already self-selected to do this cold water swimming. Personally, I have found, I'm not sure after a league basketball game, if I ice, how much that does for me. But I do know that that morning cold plunge, or in my case, I swim in the bay, that feeling is really hard to get in life, in your daily life. You're doing work. In my case, I'm, you know, kids, the whole thing. And then boom, you are thinking about nothing but that really cold ass water for however long you're in it. And it just, it clears away all the noise, all the static. And then afterwards you get this like hour of just a lift. You just feel, you feel clean, you feel ready to go. So I think that's the primary reason that I'm doing it now. You know, the athletes use it for different reasons.
Those listeners that don't know, the bay is about 52 degrees and it's murky. So there's not only that, like, oh my gosh, it's cold. There's also a, oh my gosh, what's underneath me right now? And when I surf at Ocean Beach, I just assume there's something scary there and it'll go after somebody. I thought you brought up a really interesting thing in that kind of selection bias and who writes those stories. So one of our fellows last year had done this really interesting study that my wife, who is also a writer, loves to say is a horrible study, where he surveyed marathon runners and whether or not they had knee pain and whether or not they were told to stop running. And his conclusion was, in a kind of roundabout way, it's okay to run with knee pain. And we have other data that supports it, but the way that was picked up by the lay press was, go ahead and run marathons because it's good for you, because the study showed it, rather than what the study actually showed is marathoners will run through pain, which we knew, which was absolutely crazy, but doesn't really grab the headline. So, and I think that's very true with the cold plunge stuff too. If you have, it may set off a variety of different short-term health benefits, but if it's written by cold plunge theorists and people who really like doing it, and then they expand on it and then talk about all the other healthy things that they do right afterwards, great. But from a sports medicine perspective, I don't care how people get to the healthy lifestyle. If they want cold plunge, if they want a sauna, if that makes them eat healthy and exercise, I'm all for it.
Yeah. The one takeaway, I spent about 6 months on the athletic mortality story on and off, and about 3 or 4 months on the cold plunge story. And with both of them, you read 4,000 words and it's probably disappointing to the reader to find there is no like four bullet point takeaway here. You know, with your body, it's all personalized. You have to spend the time learning how your body reacted. You know, my body wouldn't react well to marathon running at this point. You know, someone else's might, you know, depends on your nutrition, your sleep, and really cycling through. And, you know, placebo effect can be very powerful, you know, belief effects, as you know, you call it now. And the same goes for cold exposure. There's no one size fits all. If your takeaway, your Instagram hit is like, go jump in cold water, but you haven't acclimated yourself to that, and you go get in like 42 degree water in Vermont, you know, you could very well hurt yourself. You're going to have an immediate reaction. You're going to, you know, your breathing's going to shoot through the moon, and you could ingest water, and that's very bad. But if you start with a cold shower in your house, you know, that's a great way to do it. But that's hard to sum up in any little snippet.
I mean, with things like cold plunge and kind of the some of the techniques for kind of extending on careers, covering NBA teams and other sports, have you seen more of an acceptance of these kind of things at the margins? You know, how have you noticed the perception? Not just, I mean, I think players seem to have gotten on, but with kind of the older coaches were like, we ran without water, or we did all these things. Have you seen more of an acceptance of these kind of techniques?
For sure. And I think at least, you know, I started in 2000 with SI. So I'm talking about a 20-year span. I can't speak as much to the 80s, but what I've seen is almost in tandem, the acceptance of analytics and sports medicine beyond the norm. There was obviously accepted sports medicine when I first started covering the league. And it, you know, it just sort of ice things and, you know, rest and recovery was important. But there were, like, you didn't really want to veer from the status quo. Training for a team trainer wasn't what it might be today. There wasn't the interest in trying new things. And then you got, obviously, you know, body trackers played a huge part in this, being able to measure, you know, wearables, obviously. And at the same time, the analytics arise of that allowed us to see, well, here's a direct correlation between, say, sleep and performance or whatever it is. So those two things, by about 2015, it felt like, rather than it's like a slow acceptance, we're trying to break through, it had become, how can we push to the next frontier? And there was a period of a few years where some pretty fringy stuff got pulled in a bit. I don't know if you remember, Amari Stoudemire was taking baths in red wine for a while. You know,
yes.
But like, hey, if it doesn't hurt you, that's now gotten to a point where every team has, you know, multiple sports trainers and scientists and affiliations. And, you know, the P3 lab down in Santa Barbara is doing work on the body, and then someone else is doing nutrition. So now it's become an arms race, because if you can get your NBA player to play, you know, you look at like LeBron, if he can play another year at his peak, the value to your franchise is tens of millions of dollars.
It is interesting when you're talking about, yeah, keeping those star players longer, is then you see the flip side of the load management discussion now, where it suddenly starts impacting the bottom line. There's some data we have, but we're not going to release it, that load management doesn't work, even though all concepts of sports medicine suggest that decreasing load will help prevent injury. So it is an interesting mix how, you know, obviously money gets thrown in the whole conversation. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
What article are you most proud of, or was your favorite to work on in your career?
This is a little out there, but I went back and did a deep dive on my brother's college basketball team at Haverford College, which came close to setting the national record for longest losing streak. And it had this just fascinating set of characters on the team. They ended up winning in overtime against Gallaudet. And the ability not only to go and dive into a small Division III world, I love Division III sports, having played them. I also wrote about Caltech. But also to sort of take this group of athletes and 20 years later, see their memories refracted back through their lives after that, I found to be just a really fascinating experience.
That's awesome. Yeah, as a Division III athlete as well too. It is kind of an interesting mix of people who are good enough to play at the next level, but not necessarily with all the everything else around it. So it is kind of this, as you talk about people extending their careers out, Division III is like the ability to kind of live those extra 4 years. So definitely see that. What's next on the horizon for you in your writing career with all the changes that are going on out there? What are you working on?
Well, it probably won't surprise you that I'm working on a book for Simon Schuster about cold water swimming in particular. So I recently returned from the International Ice Swimming Association National Championships in Washington, D.C., where we all swam in 39 degree water. So it's a whole new world.
Did you have to get I know you referenced this in the article. Did you have to get testing beforehand? Like, is there actually like everyone has to get cleared because of that?
Yes. Yes. And everyone, anyone, especially anyone my age, because I'm 50, should definitely do it. You get EKG, you get a workup, because the shock to the system, especially when you first get in, if you can manage it and handle it well. And it's another thing to get in and then, you know, do like a 100 sprint as fast as you can, because then you're really working it. But there's this whole subculture of people who do this, and it's huge in Britain and Finland and Norway and Sweden. And it's just a nascent thing here in the States.
I can't have you leave on this, because I swam in college, or in high school and a little bit in college. And I panicked if the water was 72 instead of 73. So when they did this at 39, is it mostly like races? Is it like longest person sitting in the water, most submerged?
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be the Wim Hof approach to it, right? Just who can sit there the longest. For this event, the longest is 1,000 meters. And so for the really good swimmers, that takes about 14 minutes. And then they have a cutoff of 22 minutes. They don't want you in the water longer than that. But there's also something else called an ice mile. And this is the Everest of this world.
No.
And that is swimming a mile, you know, just your cap, your goggles, and your swimsuit in water that's 5 degrees Celsius, so about 40 degrees Fahrenheit or lower. And there's a list of, it's like 800 people in the world have done this. For the book, the narrative that I'm tracing is me going from newbie to attempting an ice mile and then talking to all these people about how they do this.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. I'm thinking Castaway would have been so much different if Tom Hanks landed in the Arctic and had to do an ice mile. It probably wouldn't have gone very well, and it wouldn't have been as nice.
Yeah. 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 No, it's, believe me, I'm swimming for about 3 minutes in this water. You feel it. So the idea of staying in there for 30, some of the people that do this, I think the mental fortitude is part of it. Body fat helps too. Body fat, swimming speed, but mental fortitude. And they report some of the same value to it that people doing cold plunges do.
So did you, well, I don't want to ruin the book. People have to read the book to figure out if you made it.
Yeah. Yeah. Ongoing, let's say.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Chris, for coming on and to our podcast 6 to 8 weeks. We really appreciate it. Big fans of your work, and want our audience to check out what's coming up for you in the future. And if anyone else wants to listen to additional episodes, we're at 6to8weekspodcast.com, and check us out on Amazon, Spotify, and where you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining again, Chris. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Great. It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the UCSF Sports Medicine Podcast, 6 to 8 weeks, perspectives in medicine. What do you think of this topic? Connect with us now. In addition to finding our contact form, you'll also find our social media links in our entire 6 to 8 weeks episode archive. Help us grow our listenership by liking, subscribing, and sharing everywhere. We're eager to hear from you, and we'll be sending you more great thought-provoking content in less than 6 to 8 weeks.